Well, I see you have not been sitting on your laurels since the last time we spoke, have you?
Working hard. 3 years worth on this one.
That's right. You gave me kind of a preview back then what it was going to be about.
And I guess I was working on it then.
You were.
In fact.
You indeed were working on it. And you told me what it was going to be about. It was kind of hard to imagine. But I would say that it's probably your most, it's your most ambitious work to date.
Absolutely. And the hardest to write.
Why did you find it so hard?
It tore the lining out of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
To answer it more seriously, the other two previous novels I've done had ready-set stories. As you know, Water Music described Mungo Park's travels to the interior of Africa in 1795. All I had to do was read Mungo's account. It had a nice beginning and a nice end. Same with Budding Prospects, which was the story of a pot plantation in Northern California, with which I was intimately acquainted. This had a nice beginning and a nice disastrous end. This time, since I grew up in Westchester, I decided to immerse myself in the history of the area. I came back in the summer of 83, I believe, for 4 months, rented a house up there, lived, went to all the historical sites I had ignored as a kid, read all the historical markers, and decided to let the themes come to me and suggest themselves to me. So it was the most difficult book because I had to invent a storyline that would develop these themes to my satisfaction.
And structurally, too, how you interconnected the historical elements with what's happening now. And your protagonist, Walter, who reminded me quite a bit of yourself. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I think there's
Except
a lot...
you have a foot.
Yeah, I still have both feet, yeah, as you can see. There's a lot of Walter in me. I think the metaphor with Walter is that his feet are not firmly attached to the ground, you know? If you don't know your history, and you're not immersed in it, and you're not a product of centuries, and you're not aware of that, well, maybe your feet aren't on the ground. There is some of me in Walter, and also, I think, in Tom Crane as well, whose initials, of course, are the same as mine.
You have a huge cast of characters. The historical elements, how accurate is this?
Every word of it is true.
Mm-hmm.
It is fiction, of course, and I invented the characters. But in many cases, they're... It is history, and it is true to an extent. The characters are sometimes based on actual people. Of course, my interest is in creating a fictional world and in paralleling the generations in an artificial way. The Beist of Van Wart, for instance, though, is based on a man I've met who now lives in the same house on the same land that was the original Dutch patent and has been in the family for all those generations. I think we're working on number 13 now. So there is an element of truth to these characters, and there is the element of possibility, too.
It must give you a tremendous amount of satisfaction to reach that that final chapter, that final sentence, and yet something tells me there's always a lot of more work that has to be done to a book, even though you finish that last line. Is that true?
Well, there is tremendous exhilaration to it. I liken it to a prize fight, you know? It's the 14th round. That guy's been hitting you in the face for 14 rounds, and suddenly he staggers slightly. Have you ever seen the fight? You go crazy to get it over with. Yeah, I finished this 3 months in advance before I promised it to Viking, for which I should get the Joyce Carol Oates Obsessives Award.
Or a bonus.
Yes.
Either one, whichever comes first.
No, it's incredibly exhilarating to finish it. To answer the second part of your question, I work page by page so that the work grows organically. And when my first draft is finished, it's pretty much complete and final and a finished product. I then painstakingly retype it on the old Underwood Olivetti my mother gave me when I went away to college years ago. A process that takes me about 6 weeks, and everyone says, "Well, this is terrible downtime. How can you do this? Get a word processor, move into the 20th century." But I enjoy the downtime because it's a way of final polishing on the book. It enables me to see it more clearly and to make the little tune-ups and adjustments that I think I need to make. I mean, if I were to push the button and have the printer start printing, I would gain 6 weeks, but I would lose this an element that's enjoyable to me of putting the final draft together. And in those 6 weeks, I'm working 10 or 12 hours a day. Then I'm working frantically, you know, of redoing the whole thing. Whereas when I'm going through the original draft, I might work from 8 or 9 till 1 or 2 in the afternoon and then forget about it for the rest of the day.
Apparently you are, however, not compulsive in the way that the poet Robert Lowell was. Lowell revised constantly poems, books of poetry that had been in print for years. He would look at and change all around. As a result, some of his books of poetry came out in a number of editions, and everything was turned around. Mm-hmm. But every time he looked at a page, he compulsively had to change it. He always saw something that he felt could make the poem better. It didn't always happen, but he felt that way. But are you content when you finally...
Yes.
6 weeks you spend with the Olivetti typing this thing, and that's it?
That's it. I think it comes a point with a work of art when it's done. Despite its imperfections, it's done. And you have to give it up and move on to the next one. Because one of the reasons you do it is for your own personal growth and to connect you to the rest of the people on the planet, you know? And I know some writers are compulsive and work over the work and I think produce less as a result. I give it up. Once I feel that I've done as well as I can do, I don't want to see it again. And my editor's very helpful. And we do sometimes rework things. But generally speaking, when I give it in, that's about it.
It's finished. Mm-hmm. What about when you receive the galleys? Aren't there? Do you have to do the checking yourself?
I sure do. You know, it's a long process from when you finish the manuscript to when it comes out. Yeah, I go through the galleys, and I do make minor changes. I do listen to my copy editor and to my regular editor, too. But again, I have the sense that because I am rather compulsive with getting that finished draft out, that it's pretty much complete when I hand it in.
It must be a terribly rewarding feeling to know that you have taken a blank sheet of paper and you've filled it with words and you've been able to impress an editor enough that the editor's bought this and published it and people are reading it. It must be a very special feeling, don't you think?
It certainly is. In fact, selling out 2 editions already is a pretty special feeling, too. And not only having the editor be impressed and buy it, but to, you know, buy all of your books and be behind you in a career way and wait for the next one. It's good. It makes it easier for you to sit down and concentrate on the job at hand, which is to produce the next work of art rather than product, you know, and know that someone's going to appreciate it and that your audience is growing and that you're reaching more people with the work.
You're still teaching, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I teach at USC 2 afternoons a week, and if I add them up, that works out to 54 afternoons a year. So it's not a tremendous strain on me, and I enjoy it. It's a way of shifting gears, especially in a long project like this when things don't go well. And believe me, a lot of the time they don't go well, and you despair. I joked about the lining of my brain. It feels like that sometimes, as if, you know, your brain is dissolving. To go teach is great. You can forget about writing the problems of the book for a day, fight the traffic on the Ventura Freeway with everybody else, come home, be exhausted, and feel that you've done something worthwhile with your day, and yet you didn't have to face those problems. The next day, maybe it's a little easier to face the problems. And again, maybe it isn't. If you're lucky, it is.
Get you out of the house, too.
Get you out of the house, that's right. And it's great.
Yeah, writing is a solitary affair, but... Well, of course, there's always the end of the day. You'd always go out, I guess.
I do physical activity in the afternoon, and I go for many forms of contemplation and or obliteration at night. Sure. And this is fun, this kind of thing. It's exhausting, yes, to go on tour and to do a lot of press interviews and radio interviews and so on. But the performance part of it I've always enjoyed. That is, getting up in front of an audience, reading them the work, presenting it to them as a performance. I love that. You know?
Well, William Kennedy has a phrase. He likes to promote his books because he calls it, it's giving the book its due.
I never thought of it that way, but I do enjoy presenting it to people live. I always read very funny work. I like to see the audience enjoying themselves. I like to remind them that literature is entertainment, that it's fun, that it's another way of occupying oneself, enjoying oneself. I mean, there is rock and roll, and there is TV and radio, but there's more, too.
Now, you seem like a rather unlikely guy to have turned into a writer. Certainly, your earliest days, was there anything in that childhood past of yours that gave you an inkling that this would happen to you?
Well, I guess you're referring to my degenerate youth. I think being awash in degeneracy all those years was good for me.
Well, because, what do you mean by degenerate? Explain yourself.
Well, without getting into specifics, I mean...
Why not?
Sort of being on the wrong side
titillate us a little
and
bit.
So on, you know. I think the typical kind of a teenage rebellion and so on may be taken to a little a greater degree. Certainly not propitious for an intellectual life. On the other hand, maybe getting some of that stuff out of my system at a younger age was good because I don't have to deal with it as much now. I mean, it never quite leaves you, but I can concentrate on my work a little more. You know, you wonder about the authors who, at an early age, get a lot of fame and fortune and how they handle it. Some burn out, like Truman Capote. Others, I guess, like John Updike, can just ride with it. I didn't have that problem. You know, I mean, my audience has grown along with me, I think.
Oh, absolutely. But you said that you got a lot of these things out of your system, these things. Because you're a young guy, you probably grew up during the beginning of this drug era. That was probably, I've talked to so many people your age, and that really sidetracked a lot of people, delayed their growth and development.
Yeah, I'm referring to those years and to drugs and, you know, brushes with the law and so on. It did sidetrack a lot of people. I think it was developmental for me. You know, I didn't really begin to write until I'd gone past that. I thought of myself as a writer and did some, what I suppose you would call juvenilia at the time. But I maintained my interest in literature through it, and it kind of bailed me out of that, gave me something to do with my life.
Because you initially wanted to be a musician, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I went away to college to be a musician. To study music. I didn't really have the talent or the discipline to pursue it at the time, and I luckily drifted into literature and discovered that I had a gift for it. And I was able to match up my profession and my gift, something that a lot of people are not lucky enough to do.
Well, I have a feeling that you would have had the discipline, that you actually did have the discipline, because anybody could sit down independently without anybody standing behind him and put together a book. And World's End is a big book. Mm-hmm. Shows that you do have discipline.
Well, now, of course, I do. I mean, there was a switch turned in my life, you know, from having been this kind of rough-edged character who barely got through college and, had to escape the draft and so on, to a guy who went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, stayed on for a PhD, and pretty much doubled his undergraduate average. You know, I made a perfect 4 points as a graduate student, whereas before I could barely get through school. I think I just decided what I wanted to do and pursued it. Maybe I grew up a little. I don't know.
Well, you certainly have an image Tika Ragginson Boyle, but not one of a professor. I mean, look you have an earring and trim beard and
yes.
Unusual garb. Is this what you wear on campus?
What
happens when you go to a faculty tea?
I don't. I don't go to faculty anything. So, I mean, my job is to teach the students, which I love to do, and write books. And so I stay away from the rest of it as much as possible. I don't really feel all that comfortable with the academic scene. It nurtures me in a way, but at the same time, they've given me the sort of deal whereby I can keep it at arm's length, too.
Now, you've lived on the West Coast for some time, but you came back to Westchester County to work on World's End. Has it ever occurred to you that maybe someday you ought to return to your roots?
More and more. It's the first time I've seen the leaves change in about 14 years, and it breaks my heart. I spent the entire day Sunday tramping through the woods up in Westchester, and it was beautiful. I mean, I'd move back tomorrow except for Lyme disease.
Yeah, no question about that. And the fish aren't so clean either in the Hudson River anymore.
No, I guess they're riddled with PCBs, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they're supposed to be getting better, but... well, what can we expect from you in the future?
Well, I've just finished about 10 new stories. I've just come back from 3 months in Ireland, and that was a very nice, restful, contemplative period. I mean, it rained perpetually. It was boring, dark, and cold, so naturally it was great for work. These will be maybe the heart of my next collection, which I hope to publish after the next novel. I'm now beginning the next novel, which deals with a Japanese in Georgia. And, of course, you can see why I went to Ireland, because anything I want to know about the Japanese or Georgia, I could just ask the men in the local pub.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, I know the Japanese have been a major influence in Georgia. and we know that that Athens, Georgia, is loaded with Japanese restaurants.
Is it?
I don't know.
I guess I'll have to do some serious research then.
Yeah, yeah. Look at all the Japanese restaurants there. Well, this is a beautifully written book, and one that that does indeed hold the reader's attention. And it shows that you are continuing to develop as a writer. You're getting better and better. And I guess, in a way, like any other trade, you learn the tricks of it, don't you? You start... Well, you didn't really... Water Music was your first, wasn't it?
Descent of Man, a collection of stories came before that. Well, that's high praise for the book, and I thank you for it. You might also mention that it is fun.
Oh, yeah.
And funny.
Yeah.
And gripping.
Yeah. here is a first novel by a young man. He's coming in this afternoon. His name is Bruce Duffy. I don't know if you've had a chance to
read it. No, I haven't read it.
And this is... I think it's even longer than your book, and it's a first novel. This guy is 31, 32, something like that. And so I read this book, and I was surprised how well it was done. A young writer, first writer, I don't even know what he's ever done before, if anything. I certainly couldn't do it, and so...
Well, I can't comment on that book per se, since I don't know it, but my first novel was a complex and a major and long work,
yes,
Water Music. Might be that's how some writers work. Maybe they just have a need a broader canvas, you know, rather than some who work more in a minimalist frame.
Well, the traditional way of developing is to write a short story, and then often there is a small collection of short stories, you know, 10 stories, and then maybe a slim novel will follow that, and then it gradually gets bigger and bigger and more complex as the writer develops his craft.
True enough, but then there are all the guys with the 10,000-page manuscripts under their beds, too. I began as a short story writer, and in fact, I got a letter recently from a former teacher, an old friend of mine, John Irving, who was responding to the fact that I had been sort of officially anointed now on the front cover of the New York Times by Benjamin DeMott, who apparently also did the same for John Irving when Garp came out. And in this letter, he... affectionately, I hope, pointed out that when I was at Iowa, I had told him that I was perfectly content to be a short story writer and had no intention of writing a novel whatsoever. I've changed my mind. And when I began Water Music, I just wanted to see if I could do it, if I knew what a novel was. And, of course, every time you get about halfway through, you think, no one's ever written a novel before. It's impossible. You can't do it. But I think, you know, there's an element of perseverance and sticking with it. And once I began to turn on this novelist's flame, I couldn't turn it off.
Yeah, Ray Carver was telling me that he doesn't anticipate ever writing a novel. He's been pushed to do it and pressed to do it, but...
I hope he doesn't.
He says he's not sure he has a novel in him.
Mm-hmm. He's another acquaintance, well, friend, a friend, actually, from Iowa. He had preceded me, I think, in around John Irving's generation, and was teaching there when I was there, and we became friends, although I didn't study with him. I think he's the best story writer in America, bar none, and I hope he continues to write these marvelous stories. I have never taught a class yet that hasn't used at least one of his books to help introduce the students to what's happening in literature today.
Now, Carver's very influential. His last book was a collection of poems, and he said that every morning he would sit down to write a story. And it just turned out to be so short to be a poem, a few lines, so he put it aside. And the next day it'd start again, and it would be another. Pretty soon he had a book's worth of poems.
Marvelous. I think that's good. Each writer seems to need to shift gears at times. The way I do it is to try a complex project like this, which takes 3 years, and immediately shift to short stories. I feel lucky that I can do that. I don't have the kind of writer's block that some novelists experience because you're so exhausted from a long project. As I did after Water Music with Budding Prospects, I'm now looking at a novel that is going to be shorter, a single storyline, the kind of thing that the reader can read at a sitting or over a day or two, rather than something that will be with you for a few weeks. After I get these next two books done, perhaps then, if the cycle repeats itself, I'll look for something larger to do.
Well, I'm encouraging all of my guests to write shorter books.
Yeah, make life easier for you.
You can see what I'm doing today, you know. Plus, I had one this morning. Fortunately, that was a thin one. But look, this is really too much of a burden on reviewers. So you guys have just got to write shorter. That's all there is to it.
Well, okay. When we get together in 2 years, boy, you'll have that book read right through in no time.
I'd say
half an hour.
I'd say 190 pages would be just about right.
You know, when I did Budding Prospects, I thought, well, I'll do something about 200 pages. It wound up being 350. So, yeah, I'd like to shoot for that. You don't know. The story has its own growth, and it suggests where it will go and where it will end. I mean, I didn't start out to write a book of this length with World's End, but I knew that I was dealing with 500 years of history and a number of complex themes. And it began to grow, to this length.
Now, you just to wrap things up, you have two classes that you teach a week, and you have creative writing students coming in with all sorts of expectations and hopes. I'm not sure what they are expecting or what they hope for, but I'm sure they all want to write a book or write a story or something. Is there any broad advice that you give them on that first day of class?
I advise them to read. I surprise them by handing out a piece of paper and asking them to list their 10 favorite works of fiction and the authors, just to see if they can do it. Almost invariably, too, the ones who turn out to be the better writers are the ones who have no problem in giving you a list of 10. Some can't write a single book down. Some only know authors from literature classes, not current authors, which is terrific, but I mean, they should also know what's happening right now. To read, and read widely and well. The writing is, after all, an assimilative process, and you've got to put something in there to get something out.
Digger Ragusan Boyle, thank you very much.
Thank you.